Today, will one phone call drop home prices by 80%? Hello, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to our latest post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Today, I'm joined by John Adams, our economist, and a special guest, Sean Quinn, who has first-hand experience of what happened in Ireland about a decade ago. So we're going to look at that in some detail because there are some lessons to be learnt, but also some parallels to be drawn and some questions to be asked. So John, let's start. The critical angle of attack here is what?
So about a week ago, when the 60 Minutes promo came out, you talked about your worst case Armageddon scenario of house prices falling 40 to 45%. That got a lot of buzz. That led to the Kakula spet. And then in the last episode that you and I did about the false Armageddon, we talked about my version of Armageddon, your version of Armageddon, and I said that if we had a full-blown depression in Australia, house prices could easily fall by 80%, now 40%. And in that episode, you said that your Armageddon scenario was based on Ireland. And the key lesson to be drawn in this episode is one bank and one phone call prevented house prices in Ireland falling from 40% to 80%. And basically what happened, basically in a nutshell, before we get Sean to go into more detail, is that the head of the ECB, the European Central Bank, got on a phone call on the 29th of September with the Irish Finance Minister, basically put a gun to his head and said, you will, at the taxpayers' expense, back Anglo-Irish Bank, or we will cut off liquidity to the Irish banking system and we will collapse your economy. And it was blackmail. It was, you know, a gun to his head at a critical moment, and the Irish blinked. They bailed out Anglo-Irish Bank and a number of other banks at a massive cost to the taxpayer. And basically, we have a you know, worsening sort of situation 10 years on in Ireland. But that's the real difference in terms of how do you get from 40% to 80%. It is whether the international community cuts off lines of liquidity, and that's a very real risk in our situation, given our foreign debt structure, and we have about $500 billion of 90-day debt.
Great. Okay. So just before we get into Ireland, the whole question here is what happens when you get into this crisis? So once we start seeing the signs of, you know, the economy failing, the home prices perhaps looking a bit wobbly, a bit like the early days in the US or in Ireland, it gets to a point where there are some critical decisions to be taken.
That's right.
And essentially the critical decision is, do you or do you not bail out the failing bank?
Yes.
Because if you don't bail out the failing bank, then essentially you go for a much deeper crunch, which is what you discussed in the last episode, right?
Yes.
If you do bail out the bank, you may not have quite such a deep crunch, but you have other significant implications post.
Yes, right? Yes. So, and there's two points to make there. So the reason why the 1892 depression in Australia was worse than the Great Depression was our banking system collapsed. So if the banks do collapse, you have a much deeper and longer lasting depression. And that carries economic and social implications with it. So that obviously has to be considered. But in the case of Anglo-Irish Bank, when the bailout occurred, there has been analysis done as to where did the taxpayer money go, and that money went to foreign banks, foreign hedge funds, and it was a bailout of the international financial cabal. So this would be the same situation here. If one of our banks got into trouble and we had to bail out one of the big four, well, who's going to get that money ultimately? It is foreign banks. And obviously that is a question of the public interest. Do we use taxpayers' money to support foreign banks, or do we actually go through a systemic restructure?
Okay, and that's really important, right? Because people need to understand that the bailout keeps the banking system afloat internationally.
Yes.
It doesn't necessarily just solve a local problem.
That's right. Yeah.
So it keeps the banking system up and running, but think about some of the consequences, and we'll come back to that, I think, at the end of the conversation, yep. because I think that's really an important point.
That's right.
So, Sean, let me turn to you. Welcome. Thank you very much for coming and spending time here. This is going to be, I think, a really interesting conversation. Mm-hmm. Let's start with just a little bit of background, because you've got a little bit of Australian history and a little bit of Irish history, but you were there in the run-up to the crunch.
Yep. I long-term immigrant to Australia, ended up with an Irish wife, and like a lot of us, decided we wanted to go back and got to the point just before the kids were ready to go to further school. Youngest one on the way, we decided to give it about 2 years in December 2006. This was a point at which the Celtic Tiger was having its pups, and everyone was incredibly buoyant in the Irish scene. After, let's be honest, Ireland has not had economic fruits in most of its history, and this was the most buoyant period in living memory that anyone had. If you were ever going to give it a shot fit to go back, that appeared to be the time to do it. It didn't take very long before I realized, though, that things were not going to progressively wind down, or there wasn't going to be any slowdown. There was going to be a bust.
The experts agree the rise in house prices has slowed, if not stopped. But when they offer predictions about the property market, some tell you soft landing and others say crash landing. Certainly the pessimists are finding their voice, for example, on last night's Future Shock programme on RTE, which pointed to signs of an impending property slump. We'll be hearing both sides of this critical debate in a few minutes, but first, here's Una Smith.
With no more growth in the housing market, the doomsaying about a crash is getting louder.
It could start tomorrow, or it could take another 2 or 3 years before that starts, but it's got to happen sometime.
It is something outside happening could puncture it here, and there would be very little you could do to prevent it.
So what are the reasons given for a likely crash? The lack of affordability has meant a drop in first-time buyers, one of the fundamentals underpinning real value in the market. Whilst in 2001, 63% of new homes were bought by first-time buyers, it's now at 33%. Furthermore, only one-third of properties are now being sold at auction, as opposed to 90% in the boom years. Others say this could simply be the start of our soft landing, with buyers holding back, hoping for the reform of stamp duty.
I'm also effectively abolishing stamp duty as we know it by simplifying the code here, by introducing three bands, 0, 5 and 9%.
The second predictor of a crash is that rents have not risen with house prices, suggesting that the market is a bubble and not driven by demand. For example, for an interest-only mortgage on a €1 million house, the mortgage is €4,000 a month, but the rent will only be half that. So if investors pull out suddenly and they make up 40% of our market, a crash is more likely. In contrast, the OECD says a soft landing is the most likely prospect, and the central bank says that house prices are not out of line with market fundamentals. The third predictor of a crash is our economy's over-reliance on construction, which has slowed by 10%. It will accelerate a downturn if jobs go and workers leave.
How long we have the job here and good conditions, we stay here. I tell you, if there start to be problem with the job here from all foreigners, they're just going back to countries, that's it.
Others argue that our economy is strong. It rose by over 6% last year and predict that it'll rise by at least 4% per year until the end of the decade, requiring over 50,000 migrant workers per year, all who will need a roof over their head. A final predictor of the crash comes from international experience. In roughly 40 cases, the bigger the boom, the more likely the bust. Given that our boom was so dramatic, with prices increasing by 270% in 10 years, our prices could fall between 40 and 60% in 9 years. The most likely trigger is the devaluing dollar, which is affecting our exports and competitiveness and could lead to multinationals pulling out. Against this, other economists say housing demand is still high for the foreseeable future as the economy grows and the population rises.
So you were there, and I think my observation of Ireland before the crash, mm-hmm. right, was There were a couple of things going on. Firstly, there was a huge construction boom, particularly in residential development.
Yep.
There was a huge uptake in first-time buyers buying this stuff that was being built.
True.
Right. And there was very lax lending.
Very lax lending.
You almost, if you had a pulse, you could get a mortgage.
Mm-hmm.
And so, therefore, there was a very significant run-up in home prices, a very significant run-up in credit.
Yep.
And prior to the cracks appearing,
mm-hmm.
everybody was just saying, this is great. We're in boom time. It's fantastic.
Exactly. The other thing, Martin, I think that's worth paying attention to, and that very few people were at that point, was the Irish financial services sector had inflated to something like 6 times regular GDP by the end of December 2006. It made its way all the way up to 8 times by the end of June 2008. But it had already taken a bit of a wobble after Bear Stearns. From that point, from on the ground, though, it had become very obvious that banks were not lending anymore to people who were finishing off some of the developments that were underway. I was pretty quickly became aware that the construction returns had come to a frightful halt. And I think that was very much part of the government's thinking in August, because it had its in August 2008, because it already had a year of much diminished tax returns from the construction industry at that point.
So you're making an interesting point. So the first leading indicator of real strain and stress was actually in that construction end of things, right?
Yeah.
And interesting here, I've been talking to people in the construction industry in the last 2 or 3 weeks, and they're all saying, we can't sell the ones we've built. We're having to deeply discount to get anybody interested. In fact, we're now beginning to think about renting rather than mm-hmm. actually selling, and we're not buying any more land at the moment.
For me, Martin, it's a wee bit Neo in the Matrix. You know, the black cat walks past.
Yep.
What's deja vu?
Yep.
Yes, I'm in
deja
that scene.
Deja vu all over again.
I'm in that scene, and this is deja vu.
Okay. Yep. And now the other thing we should say is that you've not only got feet on the ground then, but you've actually looked at it since, right? So you've looked at what happened. So so you're also talking a little bit from a slightly more academic perspective. You're actually able to go on at the moment, right?
Yeah.
So let's try and get into some of the detail, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so there was the the massive run up, then the cracks started to appear, right? And it got to the point, I think, in about September a decade ago, when things really started looking pretty sick. So let's go from there. And can you just play it over as to what happened? And it all centres on the AIB, doesn't it?
It mostly centres on Anglo-Irish Bank. Anglo-Irish Bank had been the wide boy of the banking industry in Ireland. Bank of Ireland is a little bit like the Commonwealth Bank here in Australia. It has a reputation as a previous state bank. And it kind of sees itself as the gilt component of the banking sector. Anglo-Irish was definitely the new rich component, very much based in property. Shawnee Fitzpatrick, who became Anglo-Irish CEO at the time of its collapse and who was Anglo-Irish CEO at the time, came out of a development and construction development background himself. So this was very much the developer's bank. And Anglo, as we know, their credit raising for lending policies were quite a bit more lax than the others. And they were the ones who had bought most into unsecured bonds that were coming back out of the East Coast of America in the big loop that was the loop from German Landesbanks to the East Coast of America and back into Portugal, Italy, Ireland, Greece and Spain, now known as the PIGS.
So just to sort of make sure we're clear, what we're saying is that they were growing fast.
Yep.
They were funding their book from overseas borrowing.
Yep.
And they were actually, I think, securitizing some of their book as well.
That's true,
I understand it. But they were reliant on overseas liquidity.
Largely, Largely. And they had a couple of years of pretty decent figures.
Mm.
We now know that from the trial of David Drum that some of that was dodgy bookkeeping. But you could forgive the Irish government a little bit at the time as well. Hmm. And it didn't look that bad.
Right. And they were the third largest bank, right?
And they were the third largest bank, yeah. Okay. Altogether, I think the final figure that they ended up controlling was just short of $30 billion in unsecured debt was the total senior unsecured bondholder debt. And that is the debt that Jean-Claude Trichet held the gun to Brian Lenihan's head over, essentially, and said, you pay out this in full or the whole system falls over here today in 2011. And we've got the letters from Lenihan Trichet. We've got that interchange. It took a Freedom of Information request in Ireland to get them. Nobody was terribly happy about them being released at the time, Martin. But, you know, it made the case fairly straightforwardly that Anglo had been playing fast and loose, and that the European banks, particularly institutions like Hypo Real Estate, which if you know a little bit about the German situation, I think someone is online saying that, or someone is on record, Carlos Bastassen is on record saying that if Lehman Brothers was a collapse, Hypo Real Estate would have been a tsunami. Germany, Jörg Asmussen, who was the German minister in charge of financial services at the time, and Jürgen Stark, both of whom left and went to the European Central Bank in the wake of the sovereign debt crisis, they were both fairly instrumental in bailing out Hypo at the time, but they were very, very clear that that was German bailout for German banks, and that was not happening at an EU-wide level because they're all Bundesbank trained.
Okay, so we know then that they started getting into difficulty, right?
Yep.
And there were a number of economic triggers that created that, but they ended up leaking quite badly from a funding perspective, right? They needed huge amounts of cash on a continuing basis to keep afloat, didn't they?
Well, the interesting thing with Anglo is they actually, the morning that David Drum went and saw Brian Lenihan, he only asked for $7 billion.
Okay.
And as John has said, and John and I have discussed this before, it's not entirely clear whether that was a request to get the finance minister on the hook and real money in, more in later on, or whether they really didn't know.
Right.
I think there is an element that they didn't know. And I think that could probably account for somewhere in the vicinity of about $10 billion as far as Anglo was concerned at the time, because I don't think they honestly understood the securitization arrangements that they'd entered into themselves.
And I suspect that was part of the problem because, of course, the valuation of the securitized
debt packages
they opened them and, oh, don't know what it's worth, right? Yep. Nobody could actually work out what it was worth. That was part of the problem.
Yep.
So they had this huge liquidity issue,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And it got to the point then of basically them going to the government saying, help.
Yep, made off.
Okay.
Yep.
Right. So, again, if you look hard enough, you start seeing, you know, early leading indicators of potential. Mm-hmm. But there was this critical phone call. Now, let's talk a little bit about that, because this is really the linchpin point now, isn't it, right?
So Anglo-Irish Bank asked for two things from the Irish government. One was a blanket guarantee, unlimited liability for all of its debts, and they couldn't categorically tell the Irish government how much their debts were. Right. And then they said $7 billion, but they said seven because they... And because you know, when the court case came out later on, there were secret tapes of the Irish... of the bank executives, and they said they pulled this number out of their ass, and that's an actual quote. But what actually happened there was that they wanted to get the Irish government on the hook for some level of commitment, so that when they went to ask for more, they couldn't say no because they already had committed certain funds.
Right.
So on the 29th of September, the ministry of the Irish government met about this issue of the bailout and the guarantee. And before they concluded to give the guarantee, the Irish finance minister received a phone call from the head of the European Central Bank.
Okay. And that's the critical phone call.
Because that is the critical
basically phone. The conversation went, how did it go?
Essentially, the first part of the conversation went, we believe that you've been taking some greater interest in the nature of the bondholders. This is a fully secured bond, Minister Lenehan. There's going to be no differentiation between the various levels, seniorities of debt. This is a blanket guarantee, and we expect you to keep your word. Mr. Lenehan, don't forget, was quite unwell at this point, subsequently died of cancer very early in 2012 or 13. And I believe this was a great shock, because realistically, that party had been in government for nearly 13 years at that point, was facing re-election. That was the other thing that I think that is possibly a parallel that we should think of here. They entered into a short coalition with the Greens in Ireland. The Fianna Fáil entered into a short coalition with the Greens because the numbers in the parliament got very, very tight. And they had to go to another election. And they were trying to see if they could say something to the public that would not, you know, encourage them. I mean, the public is already completely jaded at this point. On that particular morning, the strategy had come about. David McWilliams and there's another economist, Carl Whelan, had begun to point out to the Irish government that not all debts were the same. Yeah. And the Irish government was starting to think about this, starting to make some noises about delaying the unsecured bondholders or pushing them out into the long grass, perhaps, and dealing with the core problem. At this point, Trichy wasn't having any of it. Everything had to go, including $29.3 billion in unsecured debt through Anglo-Irish Bank.
So let's just be clear. Trichy,
yep,
is the ECB president.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
So he's basically the guy with the money.
Yep.
Right?
He's controlling the purse strings.
And he's basically saying to them, if we're going to help, right?
Yep.
This is on the basis on which we're going to help, right?
Yep.
And my understanding is that basically, as John said earlier on, gun against the head, because basically, unless you do this, unless you follow precisely to the letter what it is that we want you to do,
yep,
you ain't getting any of the money.
Yep, that was a very detailed economic restructuring and bailout package.
Yep.
Yep.
Okay. Right. So.
And it was a job lot.
Yes. So yep, you either go the whole hog.
Yep. Or we have you over a barrel, sir.
Yep. Okay.
That's right. Essentially the story.
And how do we know this went on? I mean, you know, what sources are there? Because this is just not just hearsay, is it?
It's a bit The new government, the government that took over from Brodie O'Hearn's Celtic Tiger government, Enda Kenny and now Leo Varadkar, they wanted to, on the way in, they said that they would get the European Central Bank to differentiate the loan. They were not able to do that. And I think basically the only way they've been able to save electoral face subsequently was to release the letters between Trichy, Jean-Claude Trichy, and the previous minister, Brian Lenehan. So we have the black and white text. This okay. is, right. you know, there is
so no, there's real evidence. This is hard not hearsay. Evidence. Okay.
Right.
So the other point to make was that the finance minister, because he was dying of cancer and he knew he was going to die, he actually himself said a few things about what took place on that phone call.
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which is a very Irish thing to do. <let's> be honest.
So by the end of the process, right, it costs the taxpayer about 30 billion euro, is that right?
Just for Anglo, yeah.
Yeah,
just for Anglo. Anglo,
right.
Okay. Altogether, the total liabilities associated with the bailout package extended to 271 billion euros.
271 billion euros.
Yeah.
Right. So how does that compare with what the debt was previously?
90. So a total debt liability on the outside. The economist Paul de Grauw has pointed out many, many times that Ireland was probably the most fiscally rectitude state, and its debt to GDP ratio was going the opposite direction of Germany's at that point. You know, Ireland was making some savings and had been quite fiscally responsible. Still in all, 4.5 million people, and a total government debt, I think at that point in long and short term bonds, government debt accounted for about 91.3 billion. It's still a substantial amount of debt, but it was well within, you know, well within the norm for the period. And it was heading in the right direction as far as everyone was concerned. They came out of the total contra tramps with a 360 billion on the balance sheet.
So a huge increase in debt.
Huge increase.
Okay. Yeah. And the key question is, who got the money?
That's the key question. There's a famous scene with Irish journalist Vincent Brown actually taking on Jörg Osmussen and Jürgen Stark in a conference when Ireland I can't remember what it was. It was 2012 or 2013. They got the European Union presidency. Mm. So at this point, all of these officials who previously held Ireland over a barrel turn up in Ireland to celebrate the fact that it now has the ceremonial position. And Vincent Brown, who's a wonderful old irascible Irish journalist and just wasn't going to go along with the flow, put people on the spot. And the real question is, who are the unsecured bondholders for this? Sheila Killian from Limerick, who's done an extensive forensic audit on this, points out the fact is bondholders are not identified. Unlike shareholders, we really cannot know who they are. But if you trace the money has mostly gone back to Germany. The real debt was the Landesbanks. The Landesbanks in Germany had lent way beyond what the capacity was to lend. And Germany couldn't afford to bail out its own Landesbanks without another line of credit coming back in. So, for example, I don't know if you've come across the guy, but he's a very interesting character, libertarian in a lot of ways. Luke Ming Flanagan, he's been elected to the European Central Parliament or European Parliament subsequently. He reverses the whole equation and he says, at this point, the Irish people have bailed out the European banking system to the tune of 67 billion euros, which is about 40% of total ECB printings since 2009. What would have happened if Lenin had dug his heels in that morning and said no?
So, and what we know from economic history is, had the finance minister told the ECB, no, we're not playing ball, they would have cut off the lines of liquidity. Anglo-Irish would have went under. The counterparties would have went under as well. And you would have had other Irish banks having, you know, like failings as well.
Yeah.
And that would have led into a massive depression. So you look at what happened with Greece since the sovereign debt crisis. The Greek economy has shrunk 25%. You would have had something of that order in terms of Ireland. Unemployment above 30%. House prices falling 80%. And you would have had what happened in the Great Depression or what happened in the 1890s.
And the key point there is it's not just Ireland, right? Because that would have been a systemic ripple effect across the financial system. So effectively there would be a cascading failure, set of failures beyond Ireland.
Yes.
And that's the whole point, right? So effectively the money that the ECB put in was predominantly to support the total financial system.
Yep. Yep.
Ireland was in the middle of it, but actually they were seen as, I feel like, a means to an end.
Yeah.
And so AIB was nationalised.
Yep. The National Asset Management Agency was established.
Mm.
That took another, I believe, 60 billion out of the system. The idea with the National Asset Management Agency was to take the worst of the debts off the bank balance sheets. Most of those were to do with construction, particularly with AIB. So therefore, you ended up with a lot of these partially finished big estates around the country just locked up, essentially because if they had have opened them up any further, the house price would have just fallen out. You would have had an oversupply right at the point at which you couldn't have tolerated an oversupply.
The question I've got then is,
yep,
did anyone go to jail?
Last year, someone has gone to jail.
Oh, fine.
Yes, David Drum has gone to jail and they gave him 8 years.
Right. Who was David Drum?
David Drum was the 2YC with Anglo-Irish.
Okay,
Right. He was the guy, essentially, I believe, that said, just tell them 7 billion. Yeah.
Okay.
To get the ball rolling.
Took them 9 years.
Yeah.
And he's about the only one who's gone in for jail.
He's the only one that's gone down for real time, yeah. Anyway.
So, but the key point there was he fled Ireland, went to the US,
right.
And he finally was extradited back into Ireland to face the music. And 9 years on, he's gone to jail.
Just before we come back to John.
Yep.
Question I've got is, was the blanket guarantee worth it?
I think the blanket guarantee wasn't worth it because I think at some levels the behaviours are already back. And I think, unfortunately, behavioral economics tells us that we really have to experience some pain somewhere along the line to reform our behavior. I mean, I don't want to be overly theological about it, but that is essentially the behavioral economics viewpoint. Mm. I think we've lost a lot of high quality people out of the country. There has been a net immigration ever since. And you know, you only have to walk around Sydney, Melbourne, or any part. You'll run across upper middle class Irish people all over the place. They're high level of professionals.
So basically, there was a long period of austerity, right?
Yep.
Following the settlement.
Yep.
Right. A long grind.
Yep.
But maybe fundamentally, not much has changed, right? Because I'm seeing home prices rising again. I'm seeing debt rising again.
Yep.
And it's like history's almost getting to the point where you could
the big
say,
difference is the banks are much more reluctant to lend.
Right. Okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
But again, that is relative.
Right. So basically, the route that was chosen, which was perhaps the least worst from some perspectives, has probably not solved much.
Not a great deal.
Right.
Not a great deal.
So, John, why is this relevant to Australia?
So why is it relevant is that obviously in previous episodes, we've talked about household debt being at a record high in both nominal terms, but in terms of proportional disposable income. But we've also been talking about foreign debt. Now, we have about $486 billion in 90-day debt. And when you look at the amount of gross foreign debt, which has a maturity up to 1 year, we're talking about $750 billion. So most of that short-term debt is in the banks. So if we have a systemic crisis, if we have a shock coming from somewhere in the world, and basically people are struggling to make their mortgage repayments, and then one of the banks get into trouble, and I think we've talked about in terms of a previous episode about when we looked at the APRA stress test, we basically said that on the scenario that APRA modelled, according to your analysis, so remember, the chairman of APRA said that the loss would be $40 billion. You said it would be in excess of $300 billion at a decline of 4% over 3 years in terms of GDP. Two banks out of the big four would be in trouble. And basically, I showed that scenario put forward by the chairman, the economic scenario, was quite fallacious. So if one or more banks get into trouble, if they default, if the big four go, who's going to take the loss? It's the foreign creditors. It's Washington, it's Wall Street, it's London, Switzerland, etc. So what happened in Ireland can very much well happen here. Prime Minister Morrison could get a phone call from an international creditor and basically say, you will bail out the big four or we will cut you off. And if we do that, then the bailout money that has to come out, well, it's going to happen in one of two ways. So I think we've talked about this in previous episode. The amount of losses that the banks can take is about $650 billion when you look at bank reserves, the CLF, the Committed Liquidity Facility, and hybrid securities. Mm. So if they burn through $650 billion and there's still losses in excess of that, then this phone call is going to come. And then if the phone call comes, the Prime Minister and the Treasurer have a big choice to make to bail out the international creditors, because as like with Ireland, that's ultimately who's going to get the money. And then the taxpayer is going, public debt is going to go ballistic in this country. Or you basically say to the international cabal, we're not going to play ball. And if you do that, you're going to have a depression bigger than the 1890s. And we're looking at 30%, 35% unemployment. We're looking at house prices falling by 80%. We're looking at massive social cost in terms of suicide, in terms of divorce, in terms of domestic violence, drug abuse. These are real factors, real people. And so the question then becomes is, at that moment, what do you do? Now, Sean just said that 10 years on in Ireland, it wasn't worth bailing out the banks. And if I was Prime Minister at that moment, I would say, let's take the depression. Knowing the economic cost, knowing the social cost, and we are talking very significant social costs, but if you take a medium to long-term view, taking that hit, even though it's going to be horrific for a couple of years, is worth it. But I guess, yeah, and obviously, you know, when we look at the live chat in terms of what we're saying on Tuesday, you know, there was a number of DFA subscribers and followers who were saying Martin Auth should be our Prime Minister. So I guess the question for you now, so I've put my cards on the table, and you know, you can't be more honest than this. Most politicians can't be, you know, will not be willing to absorb the political cost, but also the social cost. I mean, because I think when I've spoken to certain people in Parliament, and we've gone through these scenarios, they have said the social cost is so significant that that depression is, for them, is completely off the table. So they will bail out the banks, or they will go and have a Cyprus bail-in to prop up the banks because of what the social cost is. So the question for you, Martin, is that, you know, knowing that people will die, literally, because suicides go up in depressions, knowing that, you know, domestic violence, so women will be bashed, children will go hungry, people go on drugs, crime will go up. In that moment, if you are Prime Minister, what would you do?
Oh, simple decision. I mean, it's tough, isn't it? Because you know, you're thinking, I want to get elected next time, right? You're thinking, what's the least worst route in terms of short term, right? Mm-hmm. But you've also got to say, let's understand what created the problem in the first place, which is effectively the debt bomb, right? Let's understand that if we're simply just kicking the can down the road, we've actually not solved anything. We've just moved the problem out a bit, but we haven't actually fundamentally thought about how to reset the economy, right? And it seems to me that at some point, there has to be an alt-control-delete on the way the economy works, right? So tough though it would be, if I were getting that phone call, I'd go with you, John. I would say, I think that the short, sharp, deep recession, compression, whatever you want to call it, you know, is probably the least worst option. Hard to say, but I think that's probably that would be my pick.
Yeah. And what we should do in a future episode is, so in a previous episode, I said we can have a depression and engineer it to only last 18 months. Now, that comment that I've made previously is specifically referencing the 1921 depression in the US. So we'll do a future episode on that. But I think what would be useful is that for the viewers watching this episode, they should go on YouTube and really give Martin and I and Sean feedback. What do you want for your country? Do you want a depression and a resolution to the debt bomb? Or do you want to bail out the international creditors and save the social cost, knowing that in 5 to 10 years' time, we're going to go through the whole situation again? So I think it'd be worthwhile to get the viewers' feedback, given that the three of us said, well, let's have the depression. But how many people out there really want to face those demons?
I think that's a great question. So in the comments, leave a comment. What do you think? You know, which way would you jump? Because you've heard the consequences of what Ireland did. You've heard the consequences of what we're suggesting might happen here if we went the other route. I guess the final point to make, though, is we haven't yet got to that brick wall, right? There's still some runway. So what I also would say is that we need the people who are running the show, not this show, but the big show, to actually understand how much of an issue we've got with debt, with the debt bomb, with the, you know, the banking system, right? Because you could cut this off at the pass by starting to take some decisions now. And the thing that I'm frustrated about is that we're still sort of wrestling off first base to say, haven't we got a problem? Haven't we got a problem? Well, you know, the 60 Minutes thing was an attempt to try and say, guys, we actually do have a problem, right?
And then you got pushback to say you are scaremongering.
Exactly. And right. I'm saying, yes, well, I sort of am, but I'm trying to do it for the right reasons, to say all the evidence, all the data is pointing in the same direction, right? And yet still those you know, who are making the decisions at the moment and the regulators who are trying to support the system seem to be oblivious to the reality that we're seeing from our various points of view and from the data that we're there. So I think that's the other message I want to leave from this episode. Not only is, do you want to take a very bad decision here or a very bad decision there, but also what are the things that potentially could be done if there was an awareness that turned from awareness to potential action? So, you know, my plea to the people who are actually leading the country at the moment is, guys, wake up, smell the roses. There are things you could be doing now which perhaps would stop us having to make that decision down the track.
Yep.
John, Sean, appreciate your time. Very interesting, very concerning discussion, but thank you very much for spending the time with me. So there you go. I think a very concerning conversation we've had today, but hopefully one which is on one hand realistic, but also gets people thinking. So leave your comments. Tell us what you think you would do if you got that phone call. And I'll look forward to catching up with you on our next post. If you like what you've seen here today, please like the post and share it, leave a comment. And if you also would like to support our work, please do via our Patreon page. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Thanks for watching, and I'll see you next time.